Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 28 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses with an interest in innovation and the Internet of Things become even more innovative. Today's guest is Bo Burlingham, the author of a host of books including Finish Big, Small Giants, A Stake in the Outcome, and The Great Game of Business. Bo has also been editor-in-chief of Inc. magazine and now acts as editor-at-large for that magazine. We'll learn more about what an editor-at-large does in the interview. Today we spoke about the six characteristics that make up the culture and behaviour of great companies, about the importance of a service mindset, and how business owners can maintain that mindset after they transition out of the business they've founded. This is another fascinating interview, so stay tuned. This podcast is sponsored by InnovaBiz, where we partner with innovative business owners to transform your online presence into a business generation platform that delivers exceptional results. If you want to learn more, then go to innovabiz.com.au or contact me directly through the contact information there. Now, let's get into the Innovation Hive and get the buzz from Bo Burlingham.
This is the InnovaBuzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm very excited to have here with me on today's episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast, all the way from Oakland in California, Bo Burlingham, who is the author of Small Giants and also Finish Big, among other books, and also he's an editor-at-large at Inc. magazine, whatever that means. So we'll learn more about that, I hope, today. Welcome, Bo. It's a privilege to have you on the InnovaBuzz podcast.
Well, it's an honor to be here, Jürgen.
Now, you're here because John Warrilow suggested we invite you to speak with us, so a big shout-out to John.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Now, before we talk about all things business and your experience as an editor with Inc. magazine, let's find out a little bit more about you as a person. When you were a child, did you always have ambitions to write? Did you have other ideas?
No, in fact, writing was the last thing that I thought of doing. My father was a journalist. And actually, he was a journalist for Fortune magazine. My wife tells me it couldn't have been a coincidence that I wound up being a writer at Inc. magazine. But it was definitely not something I planned on. It was more something that I stumbled on when I found myself about to be the father of my son and needed a real job.
Okay. So what were you doing before that?
I was doing freelance writing.
Yeah.
I had actually started out, there are weekly newspapers in the Boston area, and that's where I got my start writing.
Okay. And were you always a business writer?
No, actually, for the first 10 years, I knew nothing about business. When I got my introduction to business, actually, in 1982, when I was hired by Fidelity Investments. They were looking for a writer. I told them that I didn't know the difference between a stock and a bond. Mm-hmm. They said that didn't matter. They could teach me that. They wanted somebody who could write.
Yeah.
And that was really my introduction to business. Prior to that, I'd just done general interest magazine reporting.
Okay. And then at some point, you then became an editor at Inc. magazine, which must have been a pretty big step.
Yeah. Well, Inc. magazine is, I think it's fair to say, the preeminent magazine for entrepreneurs in the United States. It was started in 1979 by a guy who actually was an entrepreneur himself, and he had never really intended to become an entrepreneur, but he started a newsletter that became a magazine, and suddenly he found himself in business, and he looked around to try and see if there was anything, any magazines out there to help people like him, and there weren't. The big business magazines were writing about, you know, the conflict between U.S. Steel and the Steelworkers Union, which had very little relevance to him. So he decided he probably wasn't alone, and he started Inc. magazine in April of 1979, and I joined in actually January of 1983, and it was a very, very exciting time in American business, because it was really the birth of the entrepreneurial economy. There was a time previously where it wasn't considered a compliment to call someone an entrepreneur. It was actually an insult. It's like suggesting that they couldn't get a real job, so they became an entrepreneur. But that was beginning to change in the early 1980s, and it was changing because of the entrepreneurs like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and many others. And I was just fortunate to wind up in a spot where I could get to know them and their companies when they were very young.
Yeah, well, it certainly was a time where there was a lot of transformation going on. And one of the things I think in those days, probably the magazine was hard copy and being sent out via subscription.
It still is, actually, believe it or not. It also has a very lively website, ink.com, and we're going through the same transformation that all business publications, all publications, in fact, have to go through these days to adapt to the new order of things, but we're doing that.
Mm. But right now, my understanding is that you can subscribe to premium content online and access that content online.
Well, you can, yes, that's not the model that Inc. is using.
Okay.
That's one model.
Yeah.
The other model is sort of an aggregation model where you have so much stuff online that whenever people Google anything having to do with starting a business or running a business, they can't help but find your website.
Hmm.
I'm not sure. Well, that's a, you know, and it's been very successful for Inc. because, you know, it's what advertisers are looking for. And basically, we live or die on whether or not we can get the advertising we need to survive.
Hmm. So it's a little bit like the Google model.
Hmm?
A little bit like the Google model. Google
yes.
has real estate to sell advertising.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. All right. And then at some point you became, I think, what you've called an editor at large, which gave you more freedom to write books. Is that right?
Yeah. Basically, nobody really knows what an editor at large is or does. And basically, I say that's one of the advantages of it. I highly recommend at large as a because you can be anywhere doing anything and no one really cares. I was initially, for most of the 1980s, I was the executive editor at Inc. During that very exciting decade for entrepreneurship. And then in 1990 or 1991, I decided that I wanted to write a book about the most interesting company that I'd seen in the time that I'd been at Inc. And so I resigned as executive editor and became editor at large.
Mm-hmm. And what was that first book?
That book is called The Great Game of Business. I wrote it with Jack Stack, who is the pioneer of what is called in this country open book management, which basically he is an entrepreneur himself, and he was the manager of a factory in Springfield, Missouri in 1982. The factory was owned by International Harvester, mm-hmm. and International Harvester got into, you know, was one of the seven, well, I think the 17th largest company in the world, and then it got into all kinds of problems because they had a bitter strike and they piled up a lot of debt, and then interest rates went through the roof, and suddenly International Harvester had to sell off and close down things. And Jack and the 12 other managers at this company decided, they were, you know, there was very high unemployment at the time. It was a deep recession, and they decided that maybe they should, for their own protection, put in a bid for the company, which they did. And much to their surprise, the International Harvester accepted their bid. Now, these were not wealthy people. They were able to sort of scrounge up about $100,000 between them. They then went out and borrowed $8.9 million. They started their business with an 89-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio. You know, banks get nervous when people, when companies have more than a 1.5-to-1 ratio. And, you know, they were in a very, very tough situation because basically if anything went wrong, if they missed a payment, the bank would come in and seize the assets and sell them off, and they'd be out of business. So they decided that the only way that they could avoid this terrible fate was to make sure that everybody knew what was going on in the business. And the way that you know what's going on in a business is through its financial statements. So they went out on the shop floor, and we're talking about, this is a remanufacturing, which means that they took in dirty old engines, used engines, took them apart, replaced the parts that needed replacing, fixed the ones that could be fixed, saved the ones that could be saved. It's basically a huge recycling operation. And, you know, the people who work on the shop floor are, you know, people with maybe a high school education. And the managers, Jack in particular, went out and said, look, we're going to, we want to talk to you about business. Business is not nearly as complicated as you think. Forget everything you've heard about it. Basically, business is a game. Mm-hmm. And like any game, in order to play it, you have to get it. And in order to get it, three conditions have to exist. Number one, you have to know what the rules are. Number two, you have to get enough information so that you can follow the action and keep score. And number three, you have to care about winning or losing. You need to have a stake in the outcome. So they basically set the entire company up. They put together a bonus system where they were going to play it for a year, and every year they had a, you know, complicated set of rules, but they were rules that everybody on the shop floor could understand. And it was sort of a way, as Jack says, of tricking them into learning about business. So, you know, one year they might have as their goal improving the current ratio. Well, most people who work on a shop floor haven't the faintest idea what a current ratio is or why it's important. But they learned it in the course of that. Today, in their first year, they did $16 million and lost about $400,000. They have not that was in 1983. They have not had an unprofitable quarter since then. They are today about $600,000, but that doesn't include the company that they sold off, which would make them, you know, a little shy of $1 billion. They consist of not one, but 14 different companies, most of which are run by people who have learned about business in the company by playing the great game of business. And, you know, so you have managing directors of some of these companies that they have who started out as, you know, they started as one person started out as a janitor. Somebody else started out as the secretary. A lot of people started out as customer service representatives. And they, you know, essentially what Jack did was to turn the entire company into a school for business. And it's been fabulously successful. So that was really, we had written about them when I was executive editor of the magazine, and I had been fascinated by this and wanted to know more about it. And so I took a book contract to write about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is a fascinating story. And I guess it probably led on to one of your other books, that I'm thinking of, Small Giants.
Yes.
Where you know, you talk a lot about companies that choose not to follow a path of growth at any cost, but instead being enthusiastic or being the best they can be, and focused on quality and focused on caring for their own employees as well. Because, you know, and it's like that International Harvester example where they there's the employee, they build a stake in the game for the employee, so everybody's
on
the same page.
You know, the Small Giants came out about 10 years ago, and the subtitle of the book is Companies That Choose to Be Great Instead of Big. It doesn't mean that the companies aren't growing. They are growing, but they view their growth and their profitability as a byproduct of other things that they're doing. And, you know, these are companies that aim to have absolutely stellar customer service and have very close relationships with their customers. They create what I refer to in the book as cultures of intimacy, which are based on the principles that you build a culture around viewing your employees not just as employees, but as human beings. In other words, you view the totality of the person. That was actually the philosophy of the co-founder of Southwest Airlines, Herb Kelleher. And all these companies, you know, practice the same thing. And in addition, they are, you know, they're really bulwarks of their communities in which they do business. They're a little bit, there are some similarities between them and the Mittelstand in Germany. We have people in Germany who, and in France and in other countries in Europe, that identify with the small giants paradigm and have adopted it.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think in Europe, but certainly a little bit more than what it is here in Australia, there's still a lot of family-owned companies that haven't grown into big conglomerates that are doing very well and are probably following this philosophy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. We also actually have small giants. You may know that we have an affiliate in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
that is actually an investment company and that borrowed the name Small Giants. We've been in touch with them. I met them. We had a summit, a Small Giants summit, in Germany, and they came to it. But we have done some, you know, have a very friendly relationship with them.
Okay, I'll have to look them up.
When I say we, I should note that after Small Giants came out, there were a number of companies that came to me saying that they wanted to be in touch with other companies like them, but it was hard to find those companies.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, if you want to put together something, I'll support you on it. And they did, and they created something called the Small Giants Community, which can be found online at smallgiants.org. And, you know, there are, in fact, people from all over the world who are part of it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll put a link to that underneath the show notes and people can check that out. That's great. Yeah, I heard one of the talks that is on YouTube that you'd given where you talk about Small Giants and you talk about a business with charisma. So talk us through some of the characteristics you were referring to there.
Well, I refer to this quality. It actually goes back to when I was first working at Inc. in the early 1980s, and I had contact with all of these really extraordinary young companies, and the best of them I noticed had something very special going on with them. It was like, you know, you could feel it when you talked to their employees or their customers or when you visited them. It was like they were cool. And I didn't really have a word for it back then. In the course of writing Small Giants, I came up with a word, and I call it mojo. When leader, it's the business equivalent, really, of charisma. When leaders have charisma, you want to follow them. When businesses have mojo, you want to be associated with them. You want to buy from them. You want to sell to them. You want to wear their T-shirts and caps. If there are articles or books written about them, you know, it's sort of what you feel when you're in the presence of greatness in business. And that was really a quality that I was looking for when I went out to choose the companies I was going to write about in Small Giants. It's a little hard to define. It's sort of like what a Supreme Court justice once defined pornography as. It as being very hard to define, but you know it when you see it. The same thing is true of mojo, which is it's hard to define, but you know it when you see it.
Yeah.
And so all the companies that I chose, I went to visit them and I talked to their employees, I talked to their customers, I talked to their leaders, and they all had this sort of power of attraction. And the question I had was, where did it come from? And how are they able to hold on to it? And I decided to answer that question by looking at the qualities that they had in common and the things that they did that were similar. And I came up with six. The first was that these were all companies that were led by people who had a very clear understanding of who they were, what they wanted, and why. They couldn't have made the decisions that they made if they hadn't had that knowledge, that self-knowledge. Because usually the decisions that they were making, everybody was telling them that they were crazy. That people would say, you've got a tremendous business opportunity here, or you've got this tremendous offer on the table from a big company to acquire you, and you're crazy if you don't take it. And they would say, no, this is not what I want to do. And so they would actually turn away from the opportunity if it didn't fit in with their personal goals, the reasons why they were in business. The second quality really had to do with those communities in which they did business. And it, what was remarkable was that it wasn't just they gave back a lot to these communities, although they did give back a lot to the communities. It was also that the communities sort of molded the personalities of the business to the point where it was very hard to imagine them being anyplace else. An example is the company that really started the whole craft beer revolution in the United States, which is Anchor Brewing. Before Anchor Steam Beer came out in the mid-1970s, the reinvented Anchor Steam Beer, there really were no craft brews in the United States. Now, of course, there are thousands and thousands. You know, it's Anchor Brewing is still going strong, has new ownership, but it's still going strong. It's a fixture. It's sort of, you know, if you ever come to San Francisco, anybody come to San Francisco, they should go and take a tour of Anchor Brewing, because it's a company that was started during the gold rush. It's been through all the fires and earthquakes and everything. It's a part of San Francisco history. And, you know, you can have great craft breweries elsewhere, but there's only one Anchor Brewing, and that's in San Francisco. It's part of San Francisco. And that's something that I found with all of these companies that I wrote about. The third characteristic had to do with their relationship with their customers. What struck me was how personal they were. Even if they had thousands and thousands of companies, they went out of their way to establish personal connections with those customers in terms of the kinds of events that they sponsored, the kinds of ways that they dealt with their customers. One of the companies that I wrote about was a record label in Buffalo, New York, that was started by a singer-songwriter named Ani DeFranco. And she has hundreds of thousands of fans all over the world. And a lot of them would write in to her company, Righteous Babe Records. Every single person who wrote Righteous Babe Records would get a handwritten reply back, not from DeFranco, of course, but from people they hired. And that was because they wanted to make sure that they had this close, intimate contact, personal contact with their customers. Given that, the fourth characteristic is a little surprising, namely that for most of these companies, the customers came second. It was the employees that came first. And, you know, when you think about it, it makes sense, because after a company gets above a certain size, it's no longer the person at the top who is interacting with customers and suppliers every day. It's the employees. And if you really want to provide great service to your customers, it's important that those employees share the passion for the business that you have. And the only way that's going to happen is if they feel that they are really intimately a part of that business. And that's what I was talking about before in terms of these cultures of intimacy that that I write about in Small Giants. Yeah. The fifth characteristic has to do with the way that the leaders of these businesses feel about what their companies do. They're just totally crazy about it. They love it. You know, it's not just their company they love. It's what their companies do that they love. One of the companies in the book is a company that was started probably by the best known restaurateur in the United States, a fellow named Danny Meyer. His first two restaurants in New York, Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern, have for the last 15 years been the number one and two most popular restaurants in New York. And, you know, he promotes something that he calls enlightened hospitality. What he means by that is something that goes way beyond customer service. It's about making somebody who comes to visit you feel as though they are the guest in the home of someone they don't know very well, but who is really, really happy to see them. And I asked Danny what was this passion of his for hospitality, and he said, you know, I've thought about that myself, and I realized at a certain point that I have this sort of intense, almost neurotic pleasure that I get out of seeing people have a good time. And, you know, that's what turns me on.
Yeah.
And that's really the secret to his business. There's a sixth characteristic, which unfortunately I didn't identify until actually the first edition of the book came out. We've got a second edition, a 10-year anniversary edition that's coming out next year. But it has to do with the financial structure of a small giant. You know, in order to do all these wonderful things, it's there's one condition, and that is you have to be in business.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, two of the companies in the book, one of them came very close, literally during the recession, came very, very close to going out of business. They managed to survive, and they're stronger than ever today. And another company, Rhythm and Hughes, which is a computer special effects company, did, in fact, go bankrupt.
Mm.
They are a company that, if you've ever seen the Chronicles of Narnia, or you remember the movie Babe, or if you saw The Life of Pi, all of those animals, you know, the tiger in Life of Pi is a, it looks totally real, but it's a computer special effect. And Rhythm and Hughes created it and won the Academy Award for it in 2013. Unfortunately, that was 13 days after they'd filed for bankruptcy.
Mm.
And so I came up with a rule saying that in order to be a small giant, there are three financial conditions. Number one, you have to have steady gross margins that you protect. Number two, you need to have a sound business model. Number three, you have to have a healthy balance sheet. And if you have those three conditions, then you can do all these other wonderful things that small giants do. So that's what I concluded their mojo came from doing all of those things.
Okay, that's certainly pretty comprehensive. And, you know, some of the examples you talk about in a couple of presentations that I saw, you know, you compare the very early days of an Apple or a Microsoft to those sort of companies. And, of course, they've gone on to become big giants.
Right.
Yeah.
They have. And, you know, I don't mean to imply that in order to be a great company, you have to be small.
Mm.
My point with small giants, because there are obviously great large companies, that my point with small giants is that being big and being great are two totally different things.
That's right, yeah.
And they don't really have much to do with each other.
Mm.
You can be a very large company and huge multinational, and be a terrible business. They have a terrible effect, but you can also be a large business and be a great business. Same is true of small companies. The point is that it's important. It's easy when you're building a company to get caught up in the idea that the whole process is about getting as big as you can, as fast as you can. And basically what I'm urging people is to wait, stop a minute. Don't you want, if you want to have a great company, think about what you believe it is that makes a company great. And different people will have different answers to that question, and that's fine. But it's very important when you're building a company to think about what it means to you to have a great company.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of building the culture of the company around your values and your goals and ambitions and what you like to do, and then bringing people on board rather than growth for the sake of growth.
Yes, absolutely.
And if you get the culture right and you can then go on a path of growth, it usually is much more sustainable.
Right, that's true.
Hmm. So tell us a little bit about Finish Big then, which I think is your latest book.
Yes, Finish Big, the subtitle of Finish Big is How Great Entrepreneurs Exit Their Companies on Top. And it is about leaving your business. In some ways, it's sort of a sequel to Small Giants.
That's right. It's sort of seems like a logical progression.
One thing was that when I went out talking about Small Giants, I was constantly being asked, well, these seem like great companies. It sounds like they're being led by very charismatic people. What happens when those people left?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, gee, that's a very good question. The other thing was that I do a column, a regular column in Inc. magazine with actually one of the entrepreneurs who's in Small Giants, a fellow named Norm Brodsky, very successful entrepreneur. And he sold his company, and we wrote about it on a monthly basis about the whole process that he went through in selling his company. We wrote about it in Inc., and it got just a huge response from our readers, who sort of couldn't wait to hear what the next episode was going to bring. And I realized through that there was this great curiosity about what is it like to go through an exit? What is it like to go through this transition? Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about it, every entrepreneur exits their company. They may exit feet first, but they are going to exit.
Yeah.
And every company either gets sold or liquidated. You know, you may sell it to your employees, you may sell it to to somebody in your family, but sooner or later it's going to be passed on or liquidated. And so I went, you know, I did some research to find out what there was out there about this whole transition process. And I quickly realized that there was almost nothing, that everything, I mean, if you Google starting a business, you get something like, I think it's like 1.8 billion hits. And if you Google exiting a business, you get something like 27 million hits. And almost everything is about how to make sure that you sell your company for the most money. And that's certainly a good thing, to sell your money, to sell your company for as much money as you can, if that's what you want. But in fact, the money part is really not the most important part. What I found, I went out and I, you know, when I started working on this, I went out and I interviewed, because I knew very little about it, I went out and interviewed as many people who had been through this. I probably did somewhere between 100, 150 interviews with people who had been through this process. And what I found was that about half of them were reasonably happy afterwards, at the end of the day, and about half of them were totally miserable. They regretted having sold their businesses. They didn't know who they were anymore. They had no purpose in their lives. They were depressed. And so when I sat down to write Finish Big, I decided that, okay, I'm going to write about what is the difference between the ones who wind up happy and the ones who wind up really so unhappy. And one of the things I realized was that the whole process of leaving your business that the money part of it is certainly important, but that it probably only constitutes about 20 or 30% of how you're going to feel afterwards, and the other 70 to 80% is really emotional. Yeah. And I came up with 7 factors, but there were a lot of things that really sort of forced me. It challenged me to rethink a lot of the way that I looked at a business, and I realized that we have the wrong idea about building a business. We tend to think of it as a project, like, you know, building a house or building a boat or something like that. But I realized that, in fact, when you build a business, it's a journey. And like every journey, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the end is not when you build a company. That's the middle. Mm. The end is when you leave that company. And when you start to think of a business that way, it changes the way you think about what you're doing. Another thing that I really discovered was that, most of us think of the exit as an event, something that happens at the end of the journey. What I realized was that it's not an event. It's a phase of the business. Mm. You know, you have the startup phase, you have the growth phase, you have a mature phase, and you have an exit phase. And that there are, in fact, 4 stages to it. The first stage is educational. It's where you find out what's involved, what the possibilities are, what it takes to make sure that your whole journey is going to be a happy one. The second stage is strategic. That's when you build into your company the kind of qualities that are going to allow you to have the options you want at the end. Hmm. The third stage is the execution stage. That's when you call up a broker, investment banker, and you actually go out and try and find potential buyers. Or maybe you decide to sell to an ESOP and you get somebody to help you with that or whatever. Unfortunately, that's the stage that most people start at, and their chances of having an unhappy exit are much greater, much, much greater if you start there rather than at the first 2 stages. Mm. And then there's the 4th stage, which is the one everybody forgets about, but is in many ways the most important one, which actually comes after the deal.
Yeah.
It's okay, now what? And it's particularly unfortunate for people who have been so focused on getting the best possible deal that they've never thought about what's going to happen afterwards. And they suddenly get there and they're lost. And I found that with lots and lots of people who I talked to. And it was interesting because I talked to one person who had sold his company because he was sort of getting bored with it, and he felt guilty about, urging his employees to be focused on the business when he himself was having a very hard time focusing on it. So he sold the business, and he wound up in this situation. It wound up taking him 15 years to really figure out what had happened and how to go on. He just sort of drifted during that time. Finally, one of his daughters suggested that he try teaching, and he decided to go back to school, and he got his PhD he wrote his dissertation on the experiences of private company owners when they leave a business. And
yeah, it's very personal.
Through that, he figured out a lot of things about himself, including the fact that he wasn't alone.
Mm.
And one of the things that I realized when I looked at the people who were really happy, the people who were unhappy, you think about it, you can see what they're missing, and you realize that, there are a lot of things that people get out of running a business that they're not really aware of until they don't have them anymore.
Mm.
One is their sense of purpose. Another is their identity. A lot of people told me that the question they hate most after they've sold their business is somebody asks them, what do you do? And they don't know how to answer. You have a tribe, the people you show up and spend time with every day.
Hmm.
There's a sense of accomplishment. One of the things about business is that it has this report card on how you're doing, and you can see yourself making progress. A sense of structure. The business sort of tells you what you have to do next. When you suddenly wind up in a situation where you have none of these things, it can be extremely disorienting.
Mm.
It's also true that the people I found who had the best exits and who really did finish big, they all had, many of them had something in common. And it was very interesting. They were spending a large amount of time helping young entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were counseling entrepreneurs about how to exit their businesses. Some were counseling entrepreneurs about how to build their businesses. Some of them were engaged in, were doing angel investing and were engaged in, building local economies. And I realized that at least for these people, what had happened was that when they were in business, the one thing that happens, doesn't happen for everybody, but it happens for a lot of people, which is one of the great things about business is that you really are in service. I mean, at the very least, you're in service to your customers. If you weren't, you wouldn't stay in business. Very likely, you're in service to your family. For a lot of people are in service to their employees and to their community. And what I found was that the happiest entrepreneurs I met afterwards were people who had figured out how to sort of remain in service at a higher level. And really, when you think about it that way, I think it helps to. What do you mean when you say, when people ask you, well, what's your purpose? They're really asking you, who are you serving?
Mm.
It helps to have an answer to that question.
That's right. Yeah, well, you talked earlier when we were discussing small giants about, the characteristics of some of these really strong companies that had that small giant kind of attitude, and you know, one of the things there was clarity of purpose and why that drove people,
right.
And then communicating that to other people. So you know, you sell your business and you don't have what's the purpose of the next stage, that's taking away one of those big things, isn't it? It's kind of like all of a sudden one of the core needs is not being met, and unless you figure out a way to meet that after making that transition, it's probably going to be a bit of an unhappy experience.
Very true.
Mm.
Absolutely.
All right, well, this has been absolutely fascinating, Bowen, and for the audience listening, I can only recommend that you go and read, get a copy of Small Giants, get a copy of Finish Big, and read those two, because they are really fascinating insights into, you know, what makes a small company that, you know, chooses a path of greatness tick, and what are the characteristics that Bo's sort of outlined for us. But it tells a lot of stories about different companies and some of the innovative things that they've done to bring about that whole culture of greatness, and likewise with Finish Big, there's a lot of good stories there. So,
well, that's great, Jürgen. I will say that if people want to, they can go to my website, which is just BoBurlingham.com, and they can get a free chapter. If they go to BoBurlingham.com, they can get a free chapter of Finish Big and decide if they really want to read the whole thing.
Okay, yeah, that's a great idea. So we'll post a link to that under the show notes as well.
Great.
So I think it's time we move on to our buzz, as we call it, where our innovation round, which is designed to help our audience. Now, our audience are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, and you know, that we love to give them tips from the experience of the people that we're interviewing. So mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a series of five questions, and hopefully you're going to have a really insightful answer that's going mm-hmm. to inspire our audience and help them do something awesome.
Terrific. So,
first one is, what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
The number one thing is to be curious. To be curious and to have your eyes open and to be hungry for ideas. Ideas pop up in the most unlikely places, and curious people find out about them.
See them. That's right. Yeah.
Places.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorite answers to that question. Be curious. Yeah. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Just keep my eyes open, and pay attention to what I find interesting. Sometimes I don't know why I find it interesting, I'm lucky because I'm in a position where I get to meet and interview a lot of very, very interesting people.
Mm.
And they never fail to spark something in me. So that's what I do.
Okay, that's great. So, yeah, keeping your eyes open, pay attention to what you find interesting, and speaking to lots of interesting people. Do you have a favorite tool or a system that helps you to be more innovative?
Well, I don't think so.
Okay.
Since it's mainly people who are helping me to be more innovative, I suppose you could say that a telephone is my favorite tool, as well as a tape recorder. But I really do look for inspiration outside me, because I think that what's outside me is a hell of a lot more interesting than what's inside me.
Yeah. All right, that's great. And what do you based on your experience or based on the companies and people that you've interviewed, what do you think is the best way to keep a project on track?
Well, you know, you're talking to somebody who has spent his entire adult life going from one deadline to another. A lot of times I have to admit that I have not been very good at keeping my projects on track. Finish Big was supposed to take me 2 years, and it wound up taking me 5 years. So I'm probably not the best person to ask that question. Ultimately, it comes down to two things. It comes down to instinct and judgment. I should say three things: discipline, instinct, and judgment. I mean, there are times, after all, when a project gets off track and it's okay. Hmm. And the trick is to know when it's okay versus when it isn't okay.
Yeah.
You know, if I had actually tried to write Finish Big in 2 years, I doubt if I'd be on this show talking to you. So, I don't know if that's helpful to people, but...
That's good. So, really, I think what you're saying there is there might be some quality considerations there that are more important than meeting a deadline.
Sometimes. There's an old saying in the writing business... don't get it right, get it done.
Yeah.
I've never been very good at that, although I respect people who are able to follow that dictum. But when you write a book, I mean, or when you write an article, frankly, a long article, you know, it's a question of having the discipline to sit down and do it, and you just keep doing it, and you make progress as best you can, and sooner or later you get there.
Yeah, okay. What do you think is the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Well, you know, people are different. It's a question of finding something that you are really passionate about and then being the best in the world at it. I'm a big fan of Jim Collins.
Mm.
And, you know, in Good to Great, he has the hedgehog principle, where you find something that you're really interested in and that's important. Something that you can be the best in the world at, and something that you can make money at. And if you find the intersection of those three things, then you've found something very valuable.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, isn't it? All right, so what's the future for you then? Is there another book in the wings?
There probably is, but actually, I should mention that as I think I might have mentioned earlier that right now I'm working on a new 10th anniversary edition of Small Giants, which will include some revision of the chapters and two new chapters, including one chapter on the financial structure. And it's basically a chapter about how small giants die. And the idea being to help people understand how they can avoid dying. And then another chapter, which is about what's happened to all the companies since then?
Since the book.
But, you know, when you write a book and you do a profile of a company or you write about a company, it's a moment in time. And
that's
time
right, yeah.
Stop and things change, and things have changed with all the companies, and in often in very interesting ways. And so that's what I'll be writing about.
Okay, well, we look forward to that. That sounds fascinating. All right, well, this has been tremendous. Thanks, Bo. And so what would you say the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner that wants to be a leader in their field and a leader in innovation?
Well, I've come to believe that the most important quality in business is that one that I mentioned first when I was talking about the small giants, namely knowing who you are, what you want, and why. You know, that's not something that you figure out, that you decide to take a weekend and figure it out.
Yeah.
That's something most of us spend all of our lives doing. It's the most important quality, because it allows you to make good decisions, by which I mean decisions that you're going to be happy with while you're running your company. And whether those decisions have to do with innovations or anything else.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, if you've got clarity of purpose and, that's always core to everything you do, then not only do you make quick decisions because you know immediately if it's congruent with your purpose and congruent with your values, but also they're likely to be good decisions, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I would emphasize that the tricky question here is the why question. It's very easy to sort of kid yourself about who you are and what you want. My friend Norm Brodsky, when he was a young entrepreneur, he wanted one thing, which was to build a company that did $100 million in sales. If you asked him why he wanted to do that, he couldn't have told you. He just wanted it. It was going to be cool if he could do it. Today it's more like $1 billion in sales, and people don't know why they want to do it. So in order to discipline yourself, you have to ask, okay, well, why do you want to do that?
That's right, yeah. And I'm reminded, I've just reread Simon Sinek's book, Start With Why, which has the very same premise.
Sure, yeah.
All right, well, Bo, this has been absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much for all you've shared with us today. Where can people reach out to you and say thank you?
Well, the best thing is to go to my website, boburlingham.com, and you can reach me through the website.
Okay, we'll post that link on the show notes as well.
Very good.
Finally, who else would you like to see me interview on this podcast, and why? So there's the why question.
I take it that you've already interviewed John Warlow.
Yes, I have.
Who I would otherwise recommend heartily.
Yeah, John was a great guest. Yeah,
there are some great people out there. There's my co-author, Norm Brodsky, Jack Stack, who I talked about earlier, who's the pioneer of open book management, Ari Weinzweig, or Paul Saginaw at Zingerman's, which is the company that really started me looking at small giants. One of the people I write about in both Small Giants and Finish Big is a fellow named Martin Babinek, who built a very successful, now public company, and called Trinet. And he has embarked since his transition out of Trinet. He is trying to transform the economy of in the entire upstate New York, which is a very large area, And he's doing some extremely innovative things to do that. He'd be a very interesting choice.
Okay, well, that's given me a whole list of names there, five I think I noted down. So Norm, Jack, Ari, Paul, Martin will be in touch with you to get you onto the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Bo Burlingham.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So, Bo, thank you so much again for sharing your time and your insights with us today on the InnovaBuzz podcast. You've been very generous, and I've enjoyed this immensely, and I've also learned a lot more about the background of the books, and I'd certainly encourage people to go and check out that free chapter, and we'll post the link to that. And if you like what you read there, buy the book. It's available on Amazon. It's available as an ebook. I think I've read one of them as an ebook. So it's certainly well worth read. So, Bo, I wish you all the best for the future. I look forward to that 10-year anniversary edition of the Small Giants, Great Companies, and let's keep in touch.
Very good, Jürgen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed meeting Bo as much as I enjoyed interviewing him. He's definitely a very interesting person, and, as he said on the interview, something that can help us all be more innovative is speaking to and learning from interesting people. I certainly did that today, and I hope you did too. All the show notes for this episode will be at innovabiz.com.au/Bo Burlingham. That is BoBurlingham. All lowercase, all one word, no funny hieroglyphics, innovabiz.com.au/Bo Burlingham. We'll have all of the links and everything that we spoke about in the episode listed there. Now, Bo gave me a bonus today. He suggested five people for me to interview on future InnovaBuzz podcasts. Norm Brodsky, who is a Street Smarts columnist and a senior contributing editor to Inc. magazine. Jack Stack, who is the CEO of SRC Holdings. Ari Weinzweig and Paul Saginaw, who are the co-founders of Zingerman's Gourmet Food Company, which has grown to Zingerman's community of businesses. And Martin Babanek, founder of the Trinet Group. So, I'm going to be busy sending out invitations. Norm, Jack, Ari, Paul and Martin, keep your eyes on your inboxes for an invitation from me for the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Bo Burlingham. Thank you to my audience for listening to the InnovaBuzz podcast. We'd love you to review this podcast because reviews help us get found and your feedback helps us to improve. You can review us over at iTunes or Stitcher, whichever one's your favorite. And while you're there, please subscribe so you'll never miss a future episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, if you don't innovate, you stagnate. So think big, be adventurous, and keep innovating.